ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. Today you'll learn about a plan to have Alice Springs powered by 50% renewables by the year 2030.
We are at the point in Alice Springs that we are ahead of much of the rest of the country in dealing with the institutional governance and technical challenges associated from running a grid with that much renewables in it.
Also today, before 1:30, an update, an important update on the plant disease called banana freckle. Is banana freckle spreading in the territory? Can the NT once again be declared free of this disease? And how can you help? We'll be talking to the Acting Chief Plant Health Officer in just a moment. This is the Country Hour. We're broadcasting across the territory on the ABC. And g'day to those who have downloaded the podcast. A gas company that's operating in Central Australia is scratching its head today, wondering why the Territory Government struck a deal to buy gas from a company in the Beetaloo Basin without running a competitive tender process. Yesterday, the Chief Minister, Eva Lawler, confirmed that the government had locked itself into a deal to buy 40 terajoules of gas a day from Tamboran Resources for at least the next 9 years for an undisclosed amount of money. It's a take-or-pay deal, meaning the Territory Government must pay for that gas whether it needs it or not. Central Petroleum produces gas from conventional wells to the southwest of Alice Springs, and its chief executive, Leon Devaney, believes the Tamboran deal is risky.
It's a major commitment by the NT government, but it does appear very one-sided in favour of the supplier, because the obligations to supply gas is subject to a number of conditions that benefit the Beetaloo JV. The most significant, obviously, is they still need to make a final investment decision. And I would assume this means that they need to get a commercial result from their appraisal well, which I understand is being drilled later this year. So, you know, I don't think the seller has any proven reserves, and I don't think they have demonstrated full commercial flow rates from their well. So the NT in this transaction is betting big on a project and a basin that is really still in the appraisal stage.
Do you think the government's gone too early here?
Well, yes, yeah, certainly it is. In some respects, they appear to have picked a winner, so to speak. It is a bit surprising to me that the NT government didn't really run a wider competitive process. You know, we're out trying to sell a very large volume of long-term gas and didn't really get a chance to seriously engage with the NT government. So they don't even know what our pricing would be to compare it to what they've done with Tamboran. You know, it appears to us that the NT government simply picked a winner and made an announcement. So that doesn't appear to be a very efficient way to go about these quite large and substantial gas purchase arrangements.
So the NT taxpayer potentially might not have got the best deal. Is that what you're concerned about?
Well, there's always a risk. Obviously, I don't know the pricing and the details behind the GSA, so it's hard to say. But certainly, we're a major supplier in the NT. We've got a lot of uncontracted gas, similar to what the deal that was struck by Tamboran and the NT. But we really didn't get an opportunity, I don't think, to put forward the merits of our supply or even discuss price. And you got to remember, our gas is backed by reserves. We can supply it on a firm, unconditional basis. And I would think that the NT government would value that highly, given their experience with Blacktip and relying on a single field that isn't a reliable supplier at this point. So, yeah, it was a bit, we're a bit surprised by that. Obviously, the risk is that this means that if the Beetaloo Basin doesn't perform as the NT government is hoping, our gas in the NT is committed to East Coast customers, and under that scenario, the NT market will have to rely on expensive alternative gas supplies, and that to me seems like a very risky strategy.
Why do you think the NT government made this agreement with Tamboron before the company has made its final investment decision?
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that. I have heard some people say that the transaction was done to, you know, have an energy or announcement on an energy solution in the lead up to the August election. So certainly that idea has been floated. Others have said that it's simply an effort to preserve really a large number of bureaucratic government jobs. I don't know the answer to those, but the NT government is playing a role of centrally managing the NT gas market by buying fixed price long-term gas supplies and then really selling on a shorter term basis with price risk. And this sort of arrangement was necessary before the NT was connected to the East Coast 5 years ago. Back then, it was an isolated market, and that centralized management, I think, made some sense. I'm not sure that's the case now, and in fact, it is very unusual. I'm not aware of any other East Coast state that takes on this aggregator role and the associated market risks that go with it. And, you know, these risks are very real, and governments tend not to be very good at managing them. For example, 5 years ago, the NT was oversupplied with gas, which led them to underwrite the Northern Gas Pipeline. The NT is now short on gas, which means that their East Coast customer is not being supplied, and the NGP, which is a billion-dollar asset, is sitting idle. So, you know, and then now we're looking at the NT government making a very large binding 15-year agreement to buy gas from an unproven basin. So, you know, my view is that I would prefer to see governments focus on streamlining regulation to reduce the time and cost it takes to explore and bring gas to market, which, you know, which quite frankly has skyrocketed over the past 5 years. And I think if they do this, this is really the best way to have a direct impact on the supply and the price of gas in the future.
The government hasn't made the cost of this deal public, but it does say mm-hmm. that it is competitive. What do you think mm-hmm. a competitive price would be?
That's a very hard, and the reason they put that in there, it's very hard to peg down what competitive is and what market is. It is kind of what you strike. You know, the term market is not something that's very visible. You can kind of get a sense from the spot market, but term markets are harder to see. So I don't know what sort of pricing they have from that. But, you know, clearly the arrangement really seems to be quite asymmetrical in the sense that the seller has a lot of opportunity to get out of the arrangement. Through FID and through appraisal drilling and other conditions on the GSA. But it is a binding agreement that appears to require the NT government to buy that gas over a very, very long period of time, presumably at a fixed price. So they are taking risk both on the volume and on the future price of gas in the NT market. So it is, in my experience, it seems unusual that you have this involvement from really the NT government through their GOC, which is Power Water Corporation.
That's Leon Devaney, who's the chief executive of Central Petroleum, speaking to Dan Fitzgerald. The Country Hour has contacted the NT government for comment, but we are yet to get a response. Has the government failed to run a competitive tender process? And if so, why? And why is the Tamboran gas deal the best deal for the territory? Just a few questions that are still to be answered. Now, on the Country Hour yesterday, we were talking about Tamboran, and I asked a question to the territory's Minister for Mining, Mark Monaghan, about potential conflicts of interest going forward on this. Here's just a quick reminder of that exchange. The government today has signed this gas deal with a company that hasn't got all of its necessary government approvals. Now, isn't that a big conflict of interest going forward?
No, not necessarily. It's companies do that going forward to secure contracts, and they run in parallel. Yeah,
companies might do that, but you're the government that is, for example, you're at the moment assessing the environmental management plan for this company, and you're striking deals with them. Is that a conflict of interest?
Not at all, and we're really confident going forward that the deal that we're striking is the best in territories.
That's the Minister for Mining on the Country Hour yesterday. Not a conflict of interest, he said. The Territory's Minister for Environment, Renewables and Energy, Kate Warden, was asked a similar question today at a press conference. Is it a conflict of interest for Minister Warden to be at the Tamboran press conference yesterday, spruiking the government's gas supply deal with a company that she will soon need to approve or deny Tamboran's environmental management plan? This was her response.
So in the Northern Territory, we as ministers hold many hats. I also hold the hat for as Minister for Energy and Renewables. So I'm actually able to separate those two portfolio areas. The environmental work that's going on with the Tamboran agreement actually is being done at arm's length. And I heard this morning there was some debate about it not being at arm's length. That's what the EPA does, and undermining them this morning. I did hear some commentary about that. So what's really important is that that work is being done by the EPA, and then it will come to me. As Minister for Energy, I absolutely welcome the initiative that we would have gas here in the Northern Territory that comes through for Territorians to benefit. Absolutely. But that needs to be done, and I said this yesterday, in an environmentally sustainable way. And when that comes to my desk, those will be my considerations. And I will have recommendations before me that come from an independent body, the EPA, and I trust that they will do their job properly.
That is Kate Warden, who's the Territory's Minister for Environment, Renewables and Energy. If you missed our coverage on the Country Hour yesterday, including that conversation with the Mining Minister, it's all up on our podcast if you search for NT Country Hour.
We've had such fun at the wedding of the year.
Dad, wake up!
What? So what's next for Bluey?
How's it going?
Surprise!
Only another brand new surprise episode.
I don't hear singing!
It's everyone's favourite family.
What is having children like?
In a brand new surprise episode.
All right, I'm trying to raise kids here.
All new Bluey. Streaming now. Always free, always entertaining on ABC iView.
It is 13 to 1. The plant disease known as banana freckle re-emerged in the Territory back in 2022. And since that incursion, there's been 119 properties infected by this disease. As the dry season approaches, the Department of Industry is ramping up its banana freckle inspections, and it wants your help. Sally Heaton is the Acting Chief Plant Health Officer. Maybe to start here, Sally, what is the current situation in the Territory when it comes to this disease?
So the update, as we stand now, we've got 119 infected properties. All of these properties are still in our known location. So in the Greater Darwin Regional Area, there has still not been anything found out of those areas, which is really good news. We have removed a lot of those infected properties, of about 99 of them. So we're still working on that. We've got about 20 properties of what we know to go to get removals done. Mm-hmm. But now it's coming into the dry season and we can access a lot more areas. We're really ramping up our surveillance, especially in the Greater Darwin Region area, Humpty Doo, Howard Springs, Girraween, because if we find more properties, we think that's where it's going to be. It's likely to be there. So we really want to get in there in the dry, get onto the properties we haven't visited, revisit some of the properties that we have to make sure we got everything, to try and outrun this pest. Because once we know where all the infected properties are and we can remove them, then we can start concentrating on making sure, proving our area of freedom, which takes a bit of a process.
I'll ask you more about the inspections in a moment, but just on this number of 119 infected properties, how many commercial operations have been caught up in this?
So two commercial properties, which were found early on. The other thing that we're finding...
So from memory, there was one at Rum Jungle and one at Marakai.
Yeah, that's correct.
Got you. Understood. Yep.
Yeah. A lot of those properties, though, of the infected properties, they're not commercial, but they do, a large proportion of them have got a high number of banana plants. Like some properties have got, you know, a couple hundred banana plants, but they're for their own personal use, or they just give the bananas away or trade them locally. So on those 119 infected properties, we've actually removed so far over 19,000 banana stems. So if that makes sense, it's not one banana per property. Some of them have got quite a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot of bananas, what, poisoned and put in a pit?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So it's that's why for the dry, for the wet season, it's kind of did slow us down a little bit because we don't want to access properties to remove trees in the wet and wreck people's yards. So in the dry season, it's really the opportunity for us to get a lot of that work done.
Yeah, so tell us about what people in the Greater Darwin region might see in the coming months from department inspectors.
Yeah, so we've put out a lot of communication to tell people that we're in their area doing inspections and we really want people to contact us. So we're down to the last, you know, few hundred properties in the Greater Darwin region area that we need to access. Now, we haven't been able to access mainly because people are away. We can't contact them. We have no contact details. So if people see our communications, please give us a ring and see if you can book in an inspection. We'll come. We just want to have a look at your property. If you've got no banana plants, that's fine. We're done and dusted in 5 minutes. If you have got banana plants and they're clean, that's fine. With no disease, that's fine. And we don't need to take a sample. You keep your banana plants. If we do see something, we'll take a sample and we'll let you know what the outcome is and go from there. But this really is our opportunity to get onto those properties because if we can determine where all the infected properties are and get the banana plants removed as quickly as we can, it really puts us in a good spot to help make Australia and the NT free of banana freckle.
And can you talk more on that? Why is it important to get the territory declared free of this disease as quickly as possible?
Yeah, so it's really important for a number of reasons. One, we all want to have healthy banana plants. So banana freckle affects the fruit and the plant. Once your plant has it, it doesn't, your yield is not as good, your leaves die, so your bananas don't produce as well. It affects the marketability of the fruit, so that affects international trade as well. So, and once the NT has banana freckle, then it's viewed that Australia has banana freckle. But apart from protecting industry and market access reasons, it's also everyone here in Darwin, you know, a lot of people have banana plants in their backyard. We're really lucky to be able to have this tropical fruit other people don't have, and we want to keep them healthy. We want you to have good, healthy bananas.
So for those who have not had their property inspected, I assume they're likely to get a knock on the door soon or maybe a letter. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Our surveillance officers, so you'll see us out in the region, our banana freckle inspectors. If you see them around, please stop and say, hey, I haven't had an inspection. Can you come and see my bananas?
Yep.
We are sending out letters as well and trying to contact people any way that we can. One of the concerns, we are working on some weekends and after hours. So if you think, no, I can't come because I'm too busy, I'm at work, please still give us a call because we'll come at a time that's convenient for you. But it's important that we do get onto all properties, collect, and we've said this sort of before, but collecting the zeros is just as important as collecting information about where banana freckle is.
And just checking, compared to the banana freckle eradication project of about a decade ago, it's only the properties with banana freckle that lose their bananas. The next door neighbour gets to keep their bananas as long as it's healthy. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. And that's a big difference compared to last time.
That is, it's a really big difference. So, yeah, last time they removed all banana plants. This time it's like if they're healthy, you can keep them. The only difference that it might be is that we may come and want to visit your property more than once. Like I said, so at the beginning of the response, some people, you know, really good and said, yep, come check my bananas. They were good. We're going to start revisiting some of those properties to make sure they're still good. Because until we find all the infected properties and can remove those bananas, the risk is so much higher because banana freckle is still present in our environment. So that's why the push is on to try and detect them all, get rid of them all, so we can make sure and lower the risk for everyone else who's got their healthy bananas.
And what's the time frame you have in mind, Sally, on when the territory could be deemed free of this disease?
Look, it takes time to gather all that data. So it's a little bit hard to say. It's going to take us, you know, another couple of years. If we can, the sooner we can detect all the infected properties and get rid of all the banana plants, the quicker we can prove freedom. So that's why we're really pushing the message to say, please help us out now, because it's going to help everyone out in the long term and we can get it done quicker.
Well, thanks for your time today. And if people have any questions, they can call the National Banana Freckle Response Team on 8999 2136. Thanks for your time, Sally.
No, thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Sterling Tapner. I'm from Bugs Alive. I listen to the Country Hour when I'm in the tractor or when I'm feeding bugs.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. In a moment, you'll learn about a plan to power Alice Springs with 50% renewables by 2030. And also before 1:30, some tips on how to get involved in this year's Catherine Show, especially if you're running a territory cattle station. And if you've got questions about banana freckle, send them through and we'll get some answers for you. So just before the 1 o'clock news, we will speak into the Territory's Acting Chief Plant Health Officer about banana freckle and about the department starting to ramp up its banana freckle inspections. So if you live in Humpty Doo, Girraween, McMinn's Lagoon, Herbert and Howard Springs, you can expect a knock on the door, maybe a letter in the mail. And especially those who have properties that have not been inspected, the government wants to hear from you. That phone number for the National Banana Freckle Response Team is 8999 2136. Let's go to the Weather Bureau now. Sally Cutter is there this afternoon. And Sally, this southeasterly surge, where is it? What's it doing?
Well, it looks like it's probably gone through Alice Springs and Yulara. The wind's picking up there. It's quite windy for this time of day. Tennant Creek, for Tennant Creek standards, isn't that windy, but they're blowing about 30 kilometres an hour at the moment. So it's working its way northwards. They're expecting the winds to get into the top end tomorrow. And like often we see the winds preceding the drier air. So once we get into Friday, we're going to see those dew points drop and be windy through the northern half. And that's going to give some respite from the humidity in the north. Unfortunately, we could still see a few showers around that Arnhem, northeast Arnhem coastline. And so that's just still pinging away at the moment. But the showers are going to ease over the weekend if you're up in the north, that northeast corner.
I see. Millengimby Airport jagged 26 millimetres in the last 24 hours, so there's still a little bit around.
And it's a case of whether it actually gets into the rain gauge, because Snowwell hasn't had another 0.4, but if you look at the radar, there's a fair bit out there.
I've got a message here from Alan, Sally, who is wondering, is it possible for the Weather Bureau to advise on humidity levels when it talks about temperatures in the top end? We live in the tropics. The humidity often is a better gauge on how comfortable of a day it is. So With that in mind, are you able to give us a sense on the top end at the moment?
Well, probably a better gauge is actually the dew point, because temperature is, or rather humidity is temperature dependent. So, which is why it's at first thing in the morning, so in the wet season, it's close to 100%. And at the moment, we're sitting on 55% for Darwin, and Catherine, 50%. But the dew points are sort of 21, 23. And if it was much colder and you had 50% humidity, it'd probably be pleasant. But it's not too bad out there, and particularly after what we have been having. So dew point is probably a slightly better measure. I'm a fan of dew point.
You're a fan of the dew point.
Yeah.
I've just brought up the Weather Bureau's app on my mobile. It's got Darwin sitting at 58% humidity this afternoon. Is that correct?
Yeah, that'd be about right, because that's a 10-minute thing, and I'm looking at one that was probably getting... It's almost sort of 20 minutes ago. So.
Right. And what's the dew point for Darwin right now?
23.1. Whereas in Nullum... Probably a good example is Nullumboy, because we've got that dew point here. Nullumboy is about dew point 25, but their temperature is only 28. So by the time you do the relative humidity there, is 86%.
So. I think I'm more confused than when I started. The dew. I know you're a fan of the dew point, but that's...
Just think, the higher the dew point, the more revolting it is.
Does the dew point go up to 100?
No, because basically what it is the temperature which you get a cloud forming, if you cooled the air. So it won't go right up to 100, but it will go negative. If it's negative, you know it's really, really dry. And that's
how high does it go? Sally, you're killing me here. It goes up to 28.
We had 28 this year in the build-up. So anybody around Darwin, might have been 27, but anybody who experienced the deep build-up in Darwin this year, where you just sort of thought about moving and you broke out into a sort of real sweat, that was... So as the temperature went up, it looked like, the humidity is getting less. And the humidity was, relative humidity was, it's just the... It was not getting any easier for your body to lose the temperature, lose the heat.
Okay. I'm so pleased we covered that. But these are the sort of conversations you can have as the dry season approaches, because there's not as much going on weather-wise.
Yeah, because you're noticing when the dry season comes, we'll get dew points. Around 15 is really quite pleasant.
It's a beautiful dew point.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, then. Anything else we should be aware of before you go, Sally?
No, just with this wind picking up, the fire danger is picking up just up, but that's only into the moderate level, and coastal waters are getting a little bit windier, but at this stage we're not expecting any strong wind warnings out there.
Okay. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
That's okay.
That is Sally Cutter from the Weather Bureau, a big fan of dew points.
Hello, my name is Sinamala Kumana, and I'm one of the Iralka Rangers from Northeastern Arnhem Land, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
It is 12 past one. A new report has identified ways to make the Alice Springs power grid run on 50% renewables by 2030. Produced as part of the Alice Springs Future Grid Project, which is funded by the Territory Government, the report explores how different combinations of solar, wind and battery technology could be used to power the Alice. Alice Springs Future Grid Director Lyndon Friesen says the roadmap outlines four different paths to get to this 50% target.
So the roadmap is one of the pinnacle pieces of work out of the Alice Springs Future Grid Project. Over the last 3 years, a consortium of people have been working on this $12.5 million project to put together a roadmap that looks at what are the challenges and opportunities towards getting Alice Springs to 50% renewables by 2030. So I think there's three bodies of challenges that we deal with in the context of the roadmap. One is trying to predict the future, and what does that look like, and how do we think about what the future will be there? And we've had to take into account a range of plausible scenarios around what the future might be. We have to take into account what consumers and investors and all of the institutional structures want to be able to invest in and how they're going to work together. And then underpinning that, we have to understand where we are today. And the challenge we have is that the grid today has absorbed a large amount of renewables, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to absorb more renewables in the middle of the day when the sun's shining without actually causing instability in the existing generation. And the roadmap seeks to try and put all those bits together with a plan to the future.
So let's simplify this down for people who might not have the technical expertise. So the grid is talking about, you know, power lines, the things that literally run the power from the power station to the homes and to buildings and those sorts of things. And instability in the grid is talking about, for example, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if there's lots of solar energy being created by solar panels on people's roofs, and in the middle of the day, that's when solar is at its peak, perhaps too much energy could be going into the grid and the grid can't actually handle that. Is that an example of instability?
Sort of like that. Every second of every day, the power system has to match up the exact number of electrons that everyone in the community wants to use with the exact number of electrons that are created. If we have not enough of those, then we get brownouts and people don't have access to power. If we have too many of those and we don't have anywhere for that extra energy to go, then the power system starts to get challenged. And what actually happens is the voltage starts to get a little bit curvy and people get struggling with what's going on. But it's that balance which we're dealing with. And the ability for the power system to cope with that balance every second of every day under all the different scenarios, that's what we call a stable grid, if it can cover all of those scenarios.
At the moment, how stable is the grid?
At the moment, the grid is stable, and we're very fortunate that we have a well-regulated system with a very mature and stable operator. But we do know that the amount of solar that is going into the grid in the middle of the day, particularly periods of time like this weekend where it was cool overnight, wasn't too hot during the day, lots of sunshine, as you can see out here at the moment, and not much demand, too much solar is going into the grid, and we don't have anything to absorb it. So one of the things that the Future Grid report and the Roadmap report really calls out is a need to both manage the amount of solar going in, but what are the things we can do with that energy? And looking at grid-forming batteries as a mechanism to be able to stabilise the power system.
You already mentioned one of the potential ways to get to 50% renewables by 2030 there. Could you sort of outline those four other possible pathways?
Yeah, so we mapped out a solution space, an environment that said within this environment, there's four possible pathways that we saw as boundary conditions. We don't know exactly which one of them will be true in the end, and we don't actually even need to make that decision. But by mapping out the boundaries, we can find the space of the where we're going to end up. Those scenarios are bounded by two fundamental assumptions. One is how much rooftop PV will be there, how much are you and I and other consumers have on our roofs versus having really big centralised systems.
And sorry, a centralised system means like a solar farm.
A big solar farm. So there's a world where we have lots and lots of small things, and there's a world where you have one really big thing. So that's the difference between decentralisation and centralisation. And the other boundary is whether or not we turn off our existing engines. Turning off the power station and then running 100% on solar and batteries is technically possible, but the transition between having them on and then having them off is quite technically complex, particularly in a grid such as ours. Doing that over and over again is really challenging, but those scenarios are the map out where we think we could be, and then we've used that to work backwards to think about, well, what do we have to do today to be able to enable all of those scenarios into the future?
Is there a solution or a scenario that is the preferred option?
No. A really important part of the Future Grid process was we didn't make a judgment as to what was the preferred option. There's a whole range of different individuals, consumers and investors and government agencies who can think about what they want to do best. What we have determined is in any one of those scenarios, there's common sets of actions that need to be taken today and tomorrow and the day after. If we don't take those, then you start to eliminate those opportunities in the future.
Why is it so important that this is something that has happened?
The path to 50% renewables by 2030 is something that's been published by government policy. But the reality is it doesn't matter whether it's 40% or 50% or 60%. Consumer demand and climate change are driving us to having to consider how do we increase renewables in the grid. We are at the point in Alice Springs that we are ahead of much of the rest of the country in dealing with the institutional governance and technical challenges associated from running a grid with that much renewables in it. Us finding out how to solve it helps us. It helps the rest of the NT, but it also has a benefit for the rest of the country.
That's Lyndon Friesen, who's the director of the Alice Springs Future Grid Project, speaking to Victoria Ellis. And you can learn more about this project up online right now if you search for NT Country Hour. Now, up next on the program, a trip to Katherine, where organisers of the Katherine Show are on the hunt for cattle. I'll tell you more next. Whatever happened to good old country shows? Right across the territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. The Katherine Show is on in about 3 months' time, July 19, July 20, and organisers this year are calling on NT cattle stations to get involved. Katherine Show coordinator Tiffany Davey says the cattle pavilion and judging is a great way for the beef industry to show itself off. And of course, winning a blue ribbon is always good for business. It's good for bragging rights as well. She had a chat to Jan Kahoot about why stations should get their best cattle to Katherine this year.
The beef industry is a huge part of the Northern Territory. You know, it's a state built on beef. So ensuring that that is a part of our show is really important. We've got, you know, we had 34,000 people come to the show last year. And we want them to know that it is still a true blue agriculture show. And it's an opportunity, I think, for station people to bring their cattle in and showcase them to the rest of the state. But as well as you get to compare yourself to the neighbour, that's people secretly love doing that. So we encourage that, to see what the neighbour's up to, what your pen of cattle looks like compared to the, you know, the pen next door. But then the beef paraders and the beef judging, that's a really important part of it too, the young judges, because it gives the students, it's not just students, it's open to anyone. So you've got to be, 18 to 30. It's like a way to showcase those skills. We want them to learn what a good animal looks like. And that's an important part of being a part of the ag industry, I think, to be able to identify those traits, but also giving them opportunity to compete at a national level where they can network with not only those in the NT, but those across Australia who also have a passion for cattle. And I don't think we can underestimate the importance of that, to think, but as well as showcasing it, it's about showcasing the best of the territory. And I think we've got pretty good beef up here, so we want to, you know, make sure we put that in the limelight.
So how many people entered the competition last year?
Yes, we had a few hundred entries in the end. So it was, there was two stations, which was really good. And then we had like CDU, they have an incredible line of cattle, so they brought in their stud stock, but also work with their students to ensure that they're competing in the judges and in the handlers. So this year we're hoping to grow that, you know, having to support the stations in whatever capacity to get them in and be a part of it, because it's a really, really good time.
What do you think were the barriers?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. So to bring cattle in, it's a lot of work, and you want them to look good. So you've got to go through all of, you know, well, not all of your cattle. You've got to go through, you know, your herd, and you've got to pick out the best ones, because you're not going to bring in your potty calf, even though there's a potty calf class. So bring that in if that's easiest. You can enter the potty calf, get the kids to walk it around. But it is a lot of work, and we understand that. And I think, we want to make it as easy as possible. But also for leading just to lead a cow around or to lead a steer, there's a lot involved in that. It's like you've got to break it in, and you don't want to bring it in and go wild. So it is a lot of work. And I think that's why we've had like a lack of entries, but we want to create this hype around it again, to get it back, create that competitive spirit. Create that, you know, we want them to come in and be able to compare their cattle to the neighbours. Yeah.
What would be some advice that you could give maybe stations to try and get ready for cattle judging?
Oh, probably don't underestimate how good your stock is. I think that's another factor, is people are always worried. You know, whether you talk to like farmers at the Perth Royal and like, oh, you know, my sheep are just as good as these ones. Might, well, bring them in. Like, you know, but they're always worried they're not up to scratch. So don't underestimate that too. Like, everyone is, welcome to compete. So, you know, we encourage everyone to have a look and see what they've got and bring them in. There's all different classes, so different ages, like different classes being different categories that they can enter into, whether it's a single animal or a pen of animals, different ages. So they're, yeah, it's all online, all under the cattle section on our website, so they can go through and see, have a look, see what they've got in amongst the paddocks, what might be best looking to bring it in. Yeah,
that is Tiffany Davey, who's on the Catherine Show committee. Last year, cattle from Sturt Plains Station won a few blue ribbons. The manager there, Brad Inglis, says it was well worth organising stock and taking them to Catherine.
Oh, it's really good. It's the first time Lisa and I have showed cattle, and we had them in their pens. We weren't in the lead classes, but it's what our core business is based on, and what the industry is based on, and we just, you know, promote the Brahmins and promote the Brahmin breed and promote what works in the north, I think it's just good for young people too, you know. Like, it's, yeah, horses and all that are fantastic and a great tool and a great outlet for socially for people at camp drafts and that. But we are a cattle industry, and the more we promote it, the better it'll be.
So do you reckon you'll give it a go this year again?
Absolutely, yeah. We won't be in the lead class, but we'll definitely on the commercial side of things and promote some handy cattle in the northern Australia, and hopefully other producers get on board and bring a few in. It'll be great.
That's the go, Brad Inglis from Sturt Plains. Catherine Show's on this year, July 19, July 20. Get involved. And this year, something special actually, the junior cattle judges and paraders will not only have the opportunity to compete in the state finals, which the Catherine Show's hosting this year, that's cool, the winners of that competition will then go on to compete at the national finals, which is being held at the Melbourne Royal Show in October. We've got some breaking crocodile news coming through to the Country Hour. I'll get to that in a moment, but first, here's all the prices from the Dublin markets.
Numbers increased this week as agents offered 335 live weight and open auction cattle and 130 calves. Yearling steers sold from 210 to 320 cents, as yearling heifers range from 204 to 288 cents per kilogram. Grown steers range from 272 to 280 cents, with grown heifers selling to 272 cents. Light cows sold from 120 to 140 cents, medium cows 158 to 180 cents, and heavy cows 110 to 242 cents per kilogram. Bull sold from 180 to 248 cents per kilogram. This has been Elsie Adamo, filling in for John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Elsie. I've been joined in the studio by Dan Fitzgerald. Dan, some breaking news about the Territory's crocodile management plan.
Yeah, the government has unveiled its new 10-year management plan for crocodiles, and under that, the government will allow up to 1,200 crocs to be removed every year from Territory waterways. So that's an increase from the roughly 300 or so that are currently taken out. Most of those come from Darwin Harbour, but it's well short of any sort of widespread cull, which some people had been calling for. You can see some of these details up on the ABC News website and on 7:30 tonight, where Matt Garrick has a story and he's spoken with some traditional owners in Arnhem Land who are calling for crocodile trophy hunting. I think this new management plan, it opens up for potential for that to be allowed, and there's more details on the website now.
Wonderful. Yep. Look for News NT, and there it is. Thank you very much, Dan. Hope you've enjoyed today's program, folks. Keep it rural.